Welcome to Redmond Radio, the independent voice of the Microsoft IT community. I'm Michael Domingo. Today is October 29th, and this broadcast includes a report on dual core licensing and Microsoft's latest quarterly earnings report. Plus, Redmond Magazine's Doug Barney interviews Jim Davis and Patrick Collins of the University of California system on their software negotiating secrets. First, this break. Redmond Magazine's Scott Becker filed several reports this week that include updates on dual core licensing, Microsoft's latest earnings filing, and a preview of SQL Server 2005. According to its latest earnings report, Microsoft's net income rose 11% on strong sales in its server and tools business unit for the quarter ended September 30th. Company revenues grew 12% overall, while the server and tools business grew 19%. Net income for the quarter was $2.9 billion and diluted earnings per share hit 27 cents, 2 cents over Microsoft's guidance and better than analysts had expected. Revenues for the quarter hit $9.19 billion compared to $8.22 billion for the comparable year-ago quarter. In keeping with the company-wide initiative to cut expenses out of the budget this year, Microsoft managed to keep its cost of revenues roughly flat at around $1.5 billion. In its earnings release, Microsoft highlighted the growth in server and tools revenues. Led by the flagship products Windows Server, SQL Server, and Exchange Server, the server and tools revenues were up over the year-ago quarter by 19% to $2.23 billion. Management server products, which include Microsoft Operations Manager and Systems Management Server, matched the flagship servers and revenues at 20%. Client revenues grew 7% to $2.99 billion on the strength of the overall PC market, which Microsoft estimates grew at 10% for the quarter. That growth exceeded Microsoft's expectations for PC growth of about 6% to 8%. Money losers were Microsoft Business Solutions, mobile and embedded devices, and home and entertainment. With dual-core processors from both Intel and AMD coming next year, Microsoft faced a licensing dilemma. Do right by customers by charging for only the physical processors, or do right by investors by wringing the maximum profit from each core of the processor. Microsoft followed the recommendation of its chipmakers partners Tuesday in coming down on the side of licensing its software based on physical processors. The early announcement of the decision also gives customers more definitive software acquisition costs to build into plans to move to dual and multi-core processor-based systems. Dual-core processors have two physical processor cores on a single chip. Each core can act as a two-processor system, basically doubling the power of any given chip. And AMD recently announced dual-core AMD Opteron processors running Windows Server 2003, and the chipmaker plans to ship dual-core Opterons in mid-2005. Intel plans to roll out a dual-core Xeon MP processor, codenamed Tulsa, and a dual-core Itanium 2 processor, codenamed Montecito, next year. The chip giant's roadmap also calls for four cores per processor a few years later. AMD expects the majority of its server processors will be dual-core by early 2006. Intel said it expects more than 80% of its server processor shipments to be dual-core by the end of 2006. Microsoft's new licensing policy states that server applications with per-processor licensing, such as SQL Server and BizTalk Server, will count only physical processors, not the number of cores. Similarly, Windows Server 2003 will count physical processors rather than cores in determining whether the server has too many processors for the server operating system's edition. For example, an 8-way server with dual-core chips wouldn't exceed Windows Server 2003 Enterprise Edition's 8-processor support limit, even though the system contains 16 processor cores. Microsoft's choice wasn't a straight-up or down vote of customers versus shareholders. The company said in a statement, Microsoft is approaching this decision with the goal of driving high volume and high value to standards-based computing through logical licensing and more cost-effective adoption of multi-core processors. Additionally, Windows will have to compete with a Linux operating system, which will also run on the dual-core processors. Nonetheless, Microsoft's decision stands in sharp contrast to its approach 2 years ago to the introduction of hyper-threading technology in the Intel Xeon MP processor line. Hyperthreading presented a logical second processor as opposed to the physical second processor a second core on the chip represents. At that time, Microsoft decided not to update the Windows 2000 code to fully support the technology. Microsoft released a technical preview of its upcoming SQL Server 2005 database and adjusted its timetable for delivering the next major beta. The public disclosure comes just 3 weeks after an announcement was made at SQL Server PaaS Community Summit, when Microsoft officials said the product remained on track for a beta 3 release by the end of the year, and the release of manufacturing in the first half of 2005. Paul Flessner, who was Microsoft's Senior Vice President for Server Applications, wrote in an email to customers that we're on track to deliver a solid Beta 3 in quarter 1 and a final release next summer. The SQL Server 2005 project, codenamed Yukon, has been plagued by delays for years. At one point, Yukon was supposed to be available to customers in late 2003. Offering an all-branch to Microsoft SQL Server customer base, Flutter announced immediate availability of a SQL Server 2005 Community Technical Preview. The preview version, which is the developer edition of SQL Server 2005, was immediately available to those with access to Microsoft's beta place and is supposed to be available to MSDN subscribers within 2 weeks. Major changes in Beta 3 include SQL Server integration services and improvements to analysis services. Microsoft is working on telephony-enabled client software for its Live Communication Server 2005 real-time communication server, codename Istanbul, that will ship sometime after the server's debut near the end of this year. Istanbul has been described as an overhaul of the Windows Messenger IM client that shipped in Windows XP. Windows Messenger allowed for instant messaging and presence along with some voice and video capabilities. Istanbul is expected to bring end-user call routing and the ability to create virtual meetings. Call routing is one of the most interesting aspects of Istanbul. When a call comes to a desktop phone, the user will see a prompt on screen giving options for taking the call on the computer, sending it directly to voicemail, or rerouting the call to a mobile phone. Microsoft also promises direct integration with the other Office desktop products. The Istanbul client will be dependent on Exchange Server for calendar and scheduling information, and Live Communication Server 2005, which is scheduled for release in December. According to Microsoft, Istanbul would be generally available in the first half of 2005. Finally, Microsoft has declared success in distributing more than 106 million copies of XP SP2. According to an email issued by the company, approximately 90 million were downloaded via automatic update, Windows Update, and the Download Center. And another 16 million copies were distributed via CDs, either ordered from Microsoft or distributed by Microsoft via various venues. The effort has reached about 40% of the installed base, which market researchers at IDC estimate at more than 255 million Windows XP users. Despite the needed security improvements in Microsoft's aggressive deployment campaign, many corporate customers have balked at the application rewrites and client reconfigurations that are required to get many custom and some commercial applications to work with the Windows Firewall and Lockdown Internet Explorer. Tools to help corporate customers prevent automatic downloading of SP2 have proven popular. Be sure to check out RedmondMag.com for the latest news from Microsoft. Next, how to negotiate the best deal with Microsoft. Welcome back. Want a great deal on your next big software licensing buy from Microsoft? For a November cover story, Redmond Magazine's editor-in-chief Doug Barney got Jim Davis and Patrick Collins of the University of California to reveal their negotiating secrets.
Jim, if you and Patrick can kind of introduce yourselves.
My name is Jim Davis. My title is Associate Vice Chancellor for Information Technology, and that's in effect the CIO for the campus. The campus, of course, here is UCLA.
And I'm Patrick Collins. My title is Director of Information Resources and Communications, and I am in charge of IT services at the Office of the President, just for the local office here, and I have a system-wide role, which is that I manage the vendor relations and IT contracts for the entire system.
How many employees are part of the entire system?
We have about 160,000 employees.
And are students also involved?
Students are definitely involved in our licensing programs, but frankly, they're minor relative to the employees.
Well, let's go back in time to, I think it was 2002. Jim, was it you that noticed that UCLA was paying more than it needed to for Microsoft software licenses?
A little bit of background is first of all, I have been through a negotiation with Microsoft at a previous university, and it was of the kind that was a site license. With Microsoft. This was previously with Ohio State University. I've now been at UCLA for a number of years and was noticing similar kinds of things, that within UCLA we had multiple agreements, we had variable pricing, you know, quite a bit of work that needed to go into managing these, dealing with the updates and upgrades, also recognizing that UCLA is a rather heavy Microsoft user. So my basis for starting this is when I put all those together, as well as the previous experience, it did seem like it was a worthwhile endeavor to see what we could work with on with Microsoft to make this much more systematic and as well as a lower cost opportunity for us. It was at that point we did some exploration with respect to UCLA, and then it was at that point that I raised this question with my counterparts at the other University of California campuses, and Patrick got involved as well.
And the numbers that I recall in reading some notes from a meeting from 2002, the numbers were, I think you were spending $900,000 a year or so, and you're hoping to bring that down to $600,000. Was that the expectation?
At the time we started, it was a little difficult to say exactly how much, but we were looking in multiple hundreds of savings.
And that was just for UCLA at the time?
If I could interject one thing there, which is that there are many ways to actually buy Microsoft products, and as I'm sure most of your customers know, and UCLA had a twofold problem from my perspective, which was they had the problem all the other UC campuses had, which is that everyone was going it on their own. They had an additional problem, which was that they were buying a significant amount through one of the purchasing programs, which was less advantageous. You know, they were using the open program. And there are multiple opportunities to both consolidate the spend and even just move the existing spend to a different program. But ultimately, we ended up going with campus, which was even a better approach. I mean, that's not to criticize LA. It's just that they, when they looked into it, they saw some real, they had a really big opportunity.
Right.
Doug, I want to stress, too, when we talk about savings initially in the numbers that you're referring to, this really just simply had to do, as Patrick is saying, with the variation in pricing and how the different groups on campus were using different kinds of agreements and using different kinds of programs. They simply were not being used efficiently.
Now, there's a couple ways to save on software. There's the pure licensing costs. Maybe you can help me figure out what you've been able to save there. Also, by making it simpler and having a single program, the management issues, the administration issues are eased, as well as you probably have more standardized software, so it's easier to support. Maybe we can start with the software licenses first. Do you have any sense as to what you're saving currently now that multiple campuses are involved in the campus agreement?
Yeah, one thing I'll just interject before Patrick talks about it from a UC standpoint. Actually, very glad you brought that point up. Because the pricing was certainly a factor here, but there were other factors that were really quite important in the negotiation. One was the one you just mentioned, which was the administrative overhead. And UCLA itself had, as we were saying, multiple contracts, each of which was being negotiated separately and administered separately. As I said, there was significant variation in pricing. We also wanted to ensure compliance with the copyright on the software. That was another major factor. Another benefit that we were seeking was the ability to accommodate the updates and the upgrades in a much more systematic manner, and that's not only with respect to the delivery of the software and its availability, but then also making the cost more predictable. And that, of course, was one of the goals of Microsoft. And then naturally, just as we're alluding to, there is and should be and was savings just as a result of leveraging the university size as opposed to having all these agreements. But the point I'm trying to make is that there were significant benefits other than just simply pricing.
And I think it's also important to realize that there were some very serious benefits for Microsoft. And in fact, that was central to our negotiation. When we started this thing out, just on the campus program, which is the annual subscription program, we had 80 contracts in place across the university. There's a lot of overhead for Microsoft to implement. You know, that's not just a purchase, that's an actual contract they have to maintain. Our goals were to reduce transactions and ordering individual licenses for machines, but they also had a great savings in reducing transactions. We went to one agreement instead of 80. There were those soft savings were as just as important as the hard dollar savings that were achieved by aggregating the spend.
It is voluntary, though, for different departments to join the campus agreement. They can still buy software on their own if they prefer.
This is a central feature of what we accomplished. Typically, with the campus program, it's a sort of a centrally mandated type of thing. For that reason, the program had not been deployed across the university. We, at the University of California, decentralized management and decision-making is the norm, and we generally don't mandate to, say, an academic department or to a research unit that they have to use a certain software. We had to work out with Microsoft a way that allowed the university to benefit from the aggregate spend so that every customer was paying the same price, but at the same time not mandate that every department or every campus use the program. That was really one of the major breakthroughs in this whole thing, is that Microsoft had an interest, which was to get the University of California subscribed to this program. We had an interest because of the same, but we wanted it to be with consolidated savings for everyone who joined. And so we achieved a win-win whereby people could opt in but then enjoy the benefits of the entire pool. And at this point, we have about half the university subscribed.
Having gone through this, what types of advice would you two give to other IT organizations that may want to get a better deal financially and a simpler deal to administer for Microsoft?
The one thing that was very, very important, I think, going in here is, yes, this was going to be about pricing, but there was many other factors, and we, and actually having those other factors that we enumerated a bit earlier, and looking at this from a you know, a total perspective or a whole perspective was very important, and that also gave us the ability to have multiple conversations, if you will, with Microsoft and work out different intersections that allowed concessions and arrangements and so forth that were win-wins. If you narrow the scope, I think it becomes much, much more difficult. Narrow the scope, say, for example, to just pricing. I think it's also important, from my perspective, is that with software, there actually is always other factors than just pricing. I would encourage anyone to make very, very sure that they're looking at all aspects of this and then bring those to the negotiation.
I would agree completely with what Jim said. The approach that I use, because I negotiate with all of the vendors, is, first of all, to be very positive and constructive. My sense is that you get a lot further by really approaching it in a positive win-win way, really knowing what you need. And the way I find that out is the process here is we had a system-wide team with representatives from every campus, and I represented that team. I was the lead negotiator with Microsoft. And I basically, represented very specifically what the requirements were, but at the same time, listen carefully to what Microsoft needed. And we were able to move it along in a very constructive, positive way that actually enhanced the relationship. And I guess my experience overall is that you have to put yourself in the other person's shoes and figure out, be able to think about it from their perspective and to probe for their interests. And then that puts you in a better position to figure out, help them help you. As they say in negotiations, build the bridge, And so that was the approach we took. I would also recommend that you always have very senior sponsorship for an initiative like this. The legwork ends up being done really with the sales team, but we had executive sponsors on both sides. So Jim was the main executive sponsor within UC. It was his idea. But he was involved not only in bringing the message to his campus about the benefits of this, but actually really opening up some of the other campuses to the idea through his peers. He was very, very strong on the UC side, and on the Microsoft side, we had Jack Brayman, who has since moved to another role in Microsoft, but he was the executive sponsor. So when we had big negotiation sessions, Jack was there. He was able to usher things through on the Microsoft side, because ultimately when you want to make this big of a change, both sides are nervous, and you need high-level leadership on both sides.
You guys talked about knowing what you need. Are you, in essence, talking about building a fairly detailed technology roadmap?
Not really. In some sense, the negotiation was not about future directions in technology so much as it really primarily was a licensing negotiation. But what we had was, I'll take a step back. Most software companies develop licensing programs and then try to make the customer adapt to the program. Some are more successful than others. The University of California is a unique environment. We're a very large organization, very decentralized, and we're multifaceted. And one size doesn't fit all here. And so when I say knowing what we wanted was, we proposed to Microsoft how to make the program work in our environment. And there were some very specific things we requested. And in addition to, it had to make, we had to have a cost-benefit argument that met a certain, return on investment. We weren't going to invest the effort if we didn't get a certain return. But there were a lot of structural aspects to the agreement that required, again, concessions or modifications. We didn't rely on Microsoft to come up with those ideas. We actually came up with them, ourselves, and then said, here's how we could solve this problem if Microsoft did this. What I understand from Microsoft was that they did many things for us that they had not done for other customers because it was in their interest, and that ultimately some of the things they did with us, they actually want to use with other higher education customers because they were very successful.
One of the things that was important to us was the strategic, the forward-looking view with respect to software. And so in this overall overall arrangement, we had two components to it. One was the negotiation on the campus program, but then also we agreed with Microsoft to put together some sessions, joint sessions, in which we would look ahead in terms of, shall we say, more strategic applications as well as strategic directions for the software, and that has produced some UC Microsoft sessions around that. But that was actually part of the arrangements going forward. At the other end, on your point about the analysis, you know, in some respects, it's really just standard, you know, standard preparation for a negotiation. But on something complex like this, it became quite a task. But as Patrick was saying, we did in fact list out what we believe to be the important factors. And I'm going back to just what we said before: administrative overhead, the compliance, pricing, updates, upgrades, you know, predictable price, and so forth. And then on each of those, we did a significant amount of analysis on a campus by campus basis, and we did know where our thresholds were on each one of those.
The complexity when you're doing something like this partly stems from the fact that people are already licensed under different programs, and in fact we had these existing contracts in place. The philosophy was that there would be no takeaways in this whole process, that anyone who participated would benefit. So that involved, you know, making sure that people were made whole when they you know, left an existing agreement, and that they only had incentives to come. So there was a lot of that kind of thing of dealing with, you know, moving people out of one program and into another and making sure that they weren't losing anything in that process.
Did that entire process involve hunting down what you already had for licenses and what sort of license rights you had? Was there sort of an asset management license tracking function to this whole process?
There was an inventorying process, and we don't maintain a central inventory of all Microsoft licenses, so that was a project where the campus agreements were easy to find, and as I said, there were about 80 of those, and most of them had consistent terms, but they were actually done at different times, and the campus program changed over the years. So some of those customers are under different arrangements. So we had to do a compare on the new terms with their terms, and that was again where some concessions came in to make sure that no one was losing anything. But then we did also look at the other assets that had been procured through different programs like Select, which are perpetual licenses in some cases with software assurance.
Were there any resources that you folks took advantage in preparing for these negotiations? A couple of things that I've come across, there's a book by a gentleman named Scott Braden about Microsoft licensing secrets, and there was an interesting report from Directions on Microsoft that really just detailed how all the different licensing programs work.
You know, honestly, I didn't use those two resources, but what we did was, and I forgot to mention this earlier, was that we actually brought a gentleman in from Microsoft's licensing division who was responsible really for the creation of this program, and he's the authority. So he actually became a member of the negotiation team. The gentleman's name is Enoch Remick. He understood everything about the program, not only how it worked, but why it was that way, and what the degrees of freedom were to modify it. You know, we all had the published documentation for Microsoft in the program. We had many customers who used the program and knew what they saw as its shortcomings, but then we basically went straight to the source, had Enoch in on the negotiation.
Basically, it sounds like you may have negotiated some other things under the software assurance program that might differ from the typical software assurance program that most people have. I'm wondering what kind of concessions were made outside of that that you guys were able to take advantage of.
For people who use the campus program, Microsoft actually added some software assurance benefits that have to do with training and some other rights. So that was for all customers, and that just happened to coincide with this program. There were some concessions made for people who had made software assurance investments, and this is, again, a little bit of a sensitive matter, but software assurance is a lot like the campus program. You essentially pay annually for upgrade rights, although it's used in conjunction with a perpetual rather than a term license. Those folks did not have an incentive to move into this program if they had already made an investment. And so what I'll say is that Microsoft made those customers whole, so that they did not lose any investment in Microsoft products that they had made previous to joining this agreement.
what will readers take away from this interview as far as what kind of advantages would they might they have during a negotiation with Microsoft with a licensing bias of your size? Basically, would you recommend companies with a large amount of licenses be able to negotiate a little more freely, or is it like the personal relationship that you might have with Microsoft over the long term?
I think it's both. I think, as Jim alluded to, there's a relationship issue that you want to focus on. If you just focus on price, you're not going to get there. It's a broader discussion. The advantages, clearly, on our side were size and the fact that we were doing things in a very decentralized manner. And so I would say, for someone looking at this, if you have a large size, you can bring that force to the market and influence what the market offers. In addition, if you're not managing your software assets in a consistent way, you're probably spending too much money just in the administration and the procurement and the counting and the tracking of those assets. And so we had both of those situations, and we were able to make an improvement.
Yeah, one of the things I'm interested in, it sounds like it wasn't an adversarial relationship, although I have talked to a lot of customers who felt, negotiating with a Microsoft rep was sort of a hostile environment. It sounds like you guys had a pretty good relationship to begin with, but were there any negotiating techniques that you folks invoked to try and get a better bargain and to get maybe some extra benefits from the contract?
We've been alluding to it a bit. In effect, we did start out in the opposite way that we're describing right now. We started out a bit more on with a price-focused manner, and tried to push that pretty hard, and that did put us into I think an unconstructive relationship. When we came back to the table, though, we did rearrange our approach to one which we've been describing here for the past several minutes, and broadened out to what we. To the factors that were really important to us, in addition to price, and then took a very, very constructive point of view with Microsoft, and much is owed to Patrick for doing that.
Everything Jim says is dead on. The technique that I used, and which I have found generally successful, is that I am personally not the customer, and that's not always the case, but I represent many, many customers from across the university. At one campus, we may have literally 300 departments that buy software. And then I have a campus representative at each of those sites, in some cases more. During this negotiation, I held conference calls with, each campus with many departments on a campus. My technique was to say to Microsoft, this is what the customer needs. I'm just a mediator here. I'm not here to try to make you do something you don't want to do, but simply to relay these requirements. And that kind of takes some of the adversarial thing out. It was just very effective.
Yeah, one thing I've found in my research is that there's power in numbers, not just sheer volumes, which gets you more discounts, but when you have a negotiating team that has the type of executive buy-in that you folks talked about, that has a strong legal, strong backing from the legal department, and you come in prepared, with a sizable group that's cohesive, it really strengthens your position.
No, I think that's right. Being organized really matters. So, they knew that when I would sit at the table with them, that I was representing that all of us were on the same page. That when I prepared for their negotiations, that I would be having conference calls with all of the campuses and agreeing on what the negotiation points were. So I would always do a detailed agenda and just list out the points with Microsoft. And they knew that I had vetted that with all of the representatives of the campuses so that we were speaking as one.
What are some of the other advantages that you've derived from this? Obviously you're saving money. There's less overhead. It's easier to manage. But you guys, in coming together and organizing in this fashion, are there some internal benefits that you've achieved? Is there a greater sense of teamwork and sharing now?
I would say there is, because this program. I mean, Jim had actually been suggesting that we do this for quite some time before we actually took it up and decided to try it. We were pushing the envelope in terms of coordination and consolidated purchasing activity. We do a fair amount of consolidated purchasing of IT assets, but because this one has so many customers involved, so many individual departments, we were really taking it to a new level, and I think we proved that it works.
Right.
And in fact, one of the things that has come out of this is that the group that Jim belongs to, the Council of CIOs for the University System, has essentially co-invested in an expanded system-wide licensing program. And it was not only this agreement that convinced them to do that, but this was really the start of a expanded program.
For other vendors, you mean?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, so we've taken the same type of approach with a lot of success with other major vendors.
Yeah, I mean, if you can show another vendor that Microsoft has reached certain types of agreements, that's a lot of leverage.
It is. We, you know, one of the things that I try to do is fundamentally we're trying to change the playing field and say to the vendors that we want a single contract with the University of California. We're actually licensing the software in many cases to the regions, not to, you know, the UCLA campus or the Berkeley campus, and we want transparency in our dealings, and we want fairness. We want everyone to pay the same price. And in many cases, this involves a change in relationship with the vendor where they have had different deals with different campuses. And we hold up as examples the vendors that we've succeeded with. And again, Microsoft is not the only one. There's several others that have been very forward-looking with us and have really responded to this challenge. And we use those, and they set the bar for the other vendors.
And how does the Microsoft agreement apply to students?
Well, the campus program has a student option, basically provides the same software at even better prices for students. This is probably one Jim should take on.
Yeah, for the most part, we do have, in the way we operate with the students, we encourage purchase of a computer and the appropriate software and so forth, but it is not mandated in any way. And so it becomes a student personal purchase, both on a machine standpoint and a software standpoint. Where this program then plays out is primarily through the bookstore, and it provides the pricing on a shrink wrap copies of the software that the students get, or it provides a way for them to simply download it or get a CD to put it on. But it's just an individual pricing, an individual purchase.
One of the things that we're actually exploring with Microsoft is expanding the student participation in the campus program, because that is, in the same way that we're decentralized on our academic and administrative buying decisions, the students make individual buying decisions, and that presents a challenge to this program. And so I'm going to be making a proposal to them for kind of the next major joint venture, if you will, which would be to modify the program to make it more more flexible for student participation.
Obviously, you have great business sense, but my sense is that you fundamentally came from a technology background and then acquired some of these negotiation skills and business planning skills. Is that assumption correct?
That is correct, and kind of one of my big themes when I talk about this is that I really believe that these negotiations work best when they're led by someone who's from the IT community. We have very good relationships with our procurement and purchasing people who are integral to the success of these arrangements. The IT community has chosen to put an IT representative at the forefront of these negotiations. You know, as Jim alluded to, there was a broader discussion with Microsoft about roadmaps and about sharing of technical information, and workshops came out of this for technical employees and other things. And it's very difficult to know really what's needed in the IT environment or to really talk knowledgeably about competitors unless you're in the field. And so I find that one of the big challenges in these negotiations literally is having things to talk about. What I've found is that when procurement focus is a procurement discipline is the way you approach it, it really comes back to price over and over again. And what I find is that building a relationship with the vendor and talking about what's going on in the industry and what projects we're doing, and of course they're always interested in learning more about you so that they can grow the relationship. And so that seems to be just absolutely essential.
How would an IT professional gain the type of skills necessary to be a good negotiator?
I think a lot of it is listening. There are some general books. I personally, you know, have an MBA and extensive training in negotiations and just have done it for many years. So I'm trained in the Harvard model. You know, there's a great book out there, Getting to Yes, and another one, Getting Past No. That's the basic philosophy that I use, which is all about growing the value, finding out what all of the interests are, and creating the largest value that you can before you try to divide it.
Right.
And it's also called interest-based negotiations.
Right.
So, you know, I just that's the model I follow. Other people have different models, but I do think some training, you know, or some reading. Some people just have a knack for it. Being a good listener and just. You know, enjoying the process is probably the most important thing.
Well, I've got to wrap up, but I just have to say that this is has been a superb interview. You both of you guys really are knowledgeable in IT issues and truly looking out for the interest of the university. It seems like you got a deal that has worked for everyone. So I just want to thank you for taking the time.
Patrick Collins and Jim Davis' story is just one of several on negotiating software deals that you'll read about in the November issue of Ribbon Magazine. Also in November, Configuring Error-Free Remote Access Policies and 5 Admin Empowering Scripts. You can read these stories online only at redmondmag.com. That's it for this episode of Redmond Radio. For feedback on this broadcast or regarding anything you see on redmondmag.com, call me here in the Irvine, California office at 949-265-1564 or write me at mdomingo@101com.